And on the opening and welcome, I thought I would address one of the issues, Honourable Macpherson, that you raised yesterday. And one of these issues, I'm just looking for the letter itself, was, I'm just getting the letter here, from Mr. Hermans before we open up, was on the question around the Employment Creation Fund. Is that correct? Yes. Now, in the first instance, when I looked at this letter and what I had received from yourself, I was not sure if that had come through the department to one of the constituents in your area, as it were, or what. In other words, it could have been similar to the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications, in which we're all aware of that. So, not knowing how this letter had come there, I wondered if it was a letter that had been officially sent out from the department, and perhaps you could enlighten us just on that. And if it was, one certainly has knows that you also raised this matter or a similar matter in the House on the 15th of June, as you are aware. You didn't raise this matter. Now, it's 2075 question. Yeah, that's what I'm saying, right. Now, won't you put it on record?
No, I have put it in a formal question, and that was before I got sight of this letter. But the fact of the matter is, and let me just go into this, that the Employment Creation Fund sits with billions of rands, which have or should have been allocated to beneficiaries of the fund to expand their businesses and obviously to create jobs, which is administered and run by the Department of Trade and Industry. In the most extraordinary broadside by Mr. or Mrs. Masumela, who is the fund manager of the Employment Creation Fund, they accuse the National Treasury of, and I quote, undermining African leadership, hosting conspiracy theories, and all manner of bizarre and, quite frankly, crazy things, without actually getting to the heart of where the money is and why companies are not receiving the funds that they have been allocated. Now, this letter was sent out to all, as you can see, Employment Creation Fund clients, so those people who have been approved to receive money. And to date, still none of that money has been made available. Now, as the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee that oversees the DTI, I think it's absolutely critical that we get to the bottom of what is going on, why it is going on, and why billions of rands are being withheld from companies that this has been committed to. Because quite frankly, as we know from yesterday's job numbers, hundreds of thousands of people are losing their jobs. And when government is committing money through funds and schemes like this and failing to follow through on that, that is an indictment of, once again, government's inability to implement its own policies. So I think that we have a duty to investigate this, to call the DTI before us, to call National Treasury before us, and get to the bottom of what is going on before this persists any longer. And that's why I formally tabled this letter to the committee for consideration and action.
No, thank you for that. I went into this myself, of course, and I have distributed to all members. It's 13 points. Have you all got that? A list of 13 points. It's a one-pager, the Employment Creation Fund. I brought 13 copies down with me, and in short, it refers to that. I then have attached the response to the earlier question in the House, which does have some relevance as well. But what is noted here is the actual process. And it indicates that DTI administers this fund on behalf of the cluster. And that there's a process involved in getting access to this fund. A regular process and auditors conducted by independent auditors and so on. Documentation is checked for its validity and a site inspection takes place. Linked to this process is National Treasury. Their comments are taken into account as well, and a factual finding report is then drawn up in respect of those findings. The final part of that process involves the client or the applicant. And the applicant then is also taken on board directly, as you can see from these 13 points here, as I understand it. And one must be aware, and I know all MPs are mindful of the fact that funding, can't just be concluded on the basis of what the Auditor General has said per se, or an audit report has said. And such a contract would also need the application of the mind of National Treasury and DTI. And on that basis of the funds not committed, when we talk about money in the bank, the money may well be committed. One gets one's check at the end of the month, gosh, close on 100,000 for some members of parliament. But actually, after tax and your commitments, you get out 20,000 rand. So it's all very well saying, well, where's the other 80? It was all committed. And the same principle applies here. So only when that is fine-tuned are the processes set in motion fully. And if there's been a slip-up, because no system is foolproof, then the recommendations ensure that slip-up, can I put it that way, is addressed effectively, so that in future processes can be put in place that address what has been identified as a slip-up. Now, I'm simply giving you the principle of how that fund works. But what I do agree with you, under DTI, is the mandate of employment opportunities and creation. Of course it is. So what we must do in terms of our annual report, and I've spoken to staff about this, Ms. Sheldon in particular, to begin exercising her brain right now, from today, on this matter, so that when we get the annual report, and also going backwards, not just what we see there, and forwards, what is that there is there that we need to take account of? And on that occasion, to do exactly what you are proposing, Honourable MacPherson, bringing in the relevant stakeholders and those involved. And then we're able to address the matter effectively, because you are also talking, if you like, of the past as well, the annual report. So I hope that on that matter, and it won't be too long, that we can leave the matter for the moment so that we pick it up again. Honourable MacPherson?
Thanks, Chairperson. With due respect, I'd have to disagree with you. There is 508 million rand of outstanding funding that has been committed to 31 projects. We have an economy that is in crisis. These sorts of issues cannot wait until another day. We have people that can simply not continue their businesses anymore because they cannot get the funding that has been promised to them. This is one of the most extraordinary letters that I've ever seen from a civil servant towards private industry that goes on to say, and I'd like to highlight some of the quotes. I'm not sure if every committee member has been given a letter, but I did give 15 copies to the secretariat, that said, This is quite scary, and if you were a conspiracy theorist, you would be forgiven to conclude that this is a deliberate and organized to undermine African leadership and more severely to undermine and totally distort this program of the mass democratic movement on eradication of poverty, unemployment, and inequality. He goes on to say, thus, it is not the economy is actually ill because of the lack of domestic investment and all other economic, quote, mumbo-jumbo. It's partly because we have characters in the public service who are so powerful to undermine our leadership, just hell-bent on destroying the very efforts of the state to take out blacks and Africans in particular from the yoke of living in shacks that are constantly burning down with
Honourable sewage. MacPherson, may I interrupt you?
I mean, this is a letter
that
has been sent from on behalf of the government department to private companies.
I'm not aware of that.
Well, that's why, can you hold on for one moment? That's why I tabled the letter.
One moment.
I would have hoped that you would have read it when I tabled it. Can you please hold on for a moment?
Just switch off the mic, please. I said when I prefaced my response that I was not sure how this letter had got to your client. I made that clear. We are still ourselves pursuing that. I am not sure, as I sit here, whether this was simply sent out without the head of department knowing or what. I do not know. And that is why I also will pursue this further. This is a very serious matter. It is. And not one from which I wish to see the committee shooting from the hip on. Honourable Khadebe.
Chairperson, I was actually going towards your point, you know, when I was raising my hand, is that we are not privy to that letter which Honourable MacPherson is raising. But it is good that he tabled it to you so that we can be able to look at it at the right time. But, Chair, to be honest, I think the approach we have just said here is that we have to, at the right time, call the department, call the relevant stakeholders and deal with that. We cannot, as you have just also correctly said that, you don't know whether that letter is coming officially from the department. If it is coming from the department, it will be a sad day that nothing has happened, but we'll investigate further because it is unacceptable. But what we'll do, let us have all the relevant facts, but we can only deal with that if those people are here. But right now, today, Chair, until the Parliament resumes, the only subjects which we are supposed to deal with are the bills. So I think that in the process, kick in the process, whereby we can see when we can get the department at its earliest convenience for us. Thank you, Chair.
So what we are doing, Honourable MacPherson, I have already ruled on the matter. I responded to it as part of the opening because we are dealing with legislation, and I want to say publicly we appreciate you bringing this to our attention. And I have made this now. I only got it, had sight of it yesterday, but I have had this distributed today to all members. I understand. Is that correct, Mr. Hermans? Can you respond?
Chair, that's been distributed to all members.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I just
want to clarify something.
One minute, Honourable MacPherson.
I forwarded this to yourself and Mr. Hermans last week. So it's not acceptable to say that no one had sight of it until this morning. And I want the committee to know that this was sent to the chairperson and the secretariat last week. The only reason why these are on the table with these clips on is because I actually went and had them printed yesterday to have the secretariat distribute them yesterday. And that wasn't done. And that is not fair. It is not fair when members of this committee raise urgent issues in this committee that they are set aside and pushed aside to other dates.
Honourable Macpherson, we won't go down on this issue further. Suffice to say, I certainly did not see this letter until yesterday. I myself have been in London until Sunday. And let us leave it there, but it does not dilute our appreciation for bringing it to our attention as a committee. So it is here, and we are pursuing it. Having said that, I now wish to go back to the agenda because that was the opening and welcome. And I wish now to deal with the matters that some members may not be aware of in the change of program, and that is we are not meeting tomorrow, and the reason being very simple. We had a challenge in getting an opinion on having a closed meeting with respect to ITAC, because their legislation requires that they do not have an open meeting to disclose certain information. So in the absence of that, we've had to cancel that meeting tomorrow until we get that legal opinion. With respect to SABS, I had already reported on that yesterday. So members will be flown home earlier. Mr. Hermans is seeing to that through a staff assistant. All right?
Okay.
Yes. Is this on that issue?
Yeah, I just want to know.
Now, just a minute. Is this on the issue of ITAC?
It was actually on the issue of SABS, which you've just raised. Yeah, I just want to know. So
just a minute.
Yeah,
I can't switch you off, and I really don't like switching anyone off. So you have always been, quite frankly, a responsible member.
Yeah.
So let us respect each other, please, Honourable Macpherson.
A question of
your mic is still on. I do want to hear what others have to say on the issue, because yesterday we raised the issue of SABS. And I told you why we were no longer having it. I don't want to address the same matter again. Yes?
So just a question of clarity. When will we be having a discussion about SABS then?
I said yesterday, when we returned to Parliament, I have asked Mr. Hermans to draft up a fresh programme. I'm now looking at the programme. And he is proposing that it's the 28th of August. He is proposing. The agenda has not yet been adopted, the new one. That is the proposal. And that is where we are leaving it, members. So please deal with the staff with respect to your earlier flight home. And now, with apologies, can we please have Mr. Hermans address that? Sorry, the adoption of the agenda. We have a member to propose. Honourable Williams proposes. Can we have someone to second it? Thank you, Honourable Flanguini. Thank you. May I say your hair really looks very good. Now, on the apologies.
Chair, we have an apology for Mr. Mishlabo. It's part of your business. Mishlabo, sorry. Advocate Albert, party business, and Mr. Esterhazen, who's on family responsibilities. Yeah.
Well, yesterday we were all made aware of the Honourable Esterhazen, but I also know that the Honourable Tierko was offered by the Office of the Speaker. They were looking for a reasonably, comparatively younger person than myself, of course, to attend something in Paris International Function, but the invite was specifically not for my age group, or yours, Honourable Kachali, if I may put it that way. Where you fell out regrettably was on the gender element, where the whip fell out, Buyani and a few others, and Williams. So we had to look for a female. And I just want Honourable Tierko in 1 minute to tell me what it is she went for. Right.
Thank you.
With the Paris, I understand, I was envious. Do go on.
Thanks, Chair. Is it audible? Okay. Before I start, I'm joining the ANC Women's League Young Women Desk. Today we are embarking on a march that we are taking a stand against gender-based violence. It's throughout the country. Yeah, I'm marching and I'm wearing a dupe today. That symbolizes the march today. So based on that, we are saying the violence in the part of our women is escalating and it's evil, Chair. So we need to make sure that all of us in the country, women, young women, and our kids, we are safe, and we must all participate in this struggle, all of us, to make this happen and to make sure we are living in a safe country. On that note, I'll come back to Paris. Paris is a nice country. To be honest, I enjoyed my trip, but it was not a trip, it was a business trip, because the parliament deployed me to go and represent the country, to participate in the World Global Steering Committee, which is led by the World Group globally. The people who were there were countries who participated in the steering committee. It was Kosovo, Malaysia, Brazil, Turkey, Ukraine, and we were blessed with a young MP from France itself, who welcomed us, and Naye Bateli is the head coordinator parliamentary and globally. This is an initiative which has been initiated to make sure that young parliamentarians globally, they must have a say in parliament where they are participating. And the issue of the age and the participation of young blood in parliament, which is what we are trying to achieve, to say there should be to make sure that young parliamentarians, they take a lead in all spheres of the government. We had objectives that we have identified as a committee. The first objective was capacity building methods, which will fostering alliance with youth association networking, sharing national perspective on supporting youth development setups on specialized hubs in different countries, working in collaboration inclusive as well as environmental mindful ways and develop of digital enabling infrastructure in rural areas. So this one is one of them. The second one, we concentrated on education and lifelong learning, the childhood development. For you to prepare a future, you need to start it from that first 7 years of a child, where you instill discipline. So that's how we are saying the first lady in the country, I think, is one of who's championing that program. We think it will, Dr. Ramaphosa, she will make sure that that program, she must enforce it as a matter of agency, because in 20 years moving forward, we see our country, it should be an a country where there are educated people. So we need to start now for us to prepare for future, because already now we have seen that there's a gap. So we should start somewhere, and it's now that that program should be enforced. And we must make sure that our kids there are trained and that it's instilled, instead of seeing these riots left and right. And when you check, it's youth who are there because of this unemployment rate, which is escalating. The report was saying yesterday, it's confirming that we have a challenge. The third one, this youth economic and political empowerment based on fiscal and economic incentives, recognizing and valuing the status of internship and apprenticeships and civil engagement. You give internships, you don't recognize them. So it should come to a stop also, that part. Then the fourth one, the fourth objective was the promising of a more prosperous economy combined with a more equitable society, which means South Africa is affected. It doesn't only affect South Africa, it affects everyone and globally. So those are the four objectives that we concentrated on as young MPs in Paris, and they are ongoing engagement, ongoing meetings. There will be a next round of meeting. I don't know which country and when, but I would love to hand over to the young MPs for the next parliament next year, so that this program it continue and move on. So on, based on this, well, these are my trips, but however, I would like to thank the economic cluster and being in this trade and industry committee and being with all honorables here for trusting in me, sending me, and to allowing the speaker to approve me to go to Paris and represent the country on your behalf. So that's basically short of it. Thanks, Chair.
We would like to thank you. I know it was not, this committee per se that sent you, but the Office of the Speaker. However, we would appreciate, once you have communicated your report to the Speaker, if you would make a copy available to us. Because as you see, the committee priority in trade and industry is effectively to ensure that economic opportunities are created and we develop an enabling environment for jobs. So thank you very much. And yes, I do like your little duck there. Thank you very much indeed. So it's good to hear that the younger members of this committee, that includes yourself, Honourable MacPherson, and Honourable Biani, yes, we need you all. And I'm coming to you, because you're a woman, so I thought we started with a woman. Let's put the men in between in the sandwich. And then we come back to the woman, the Honourable Slanguini. You are all in the age group that will take this Parliament forward and our country. Thank you very much. We now, members, we have got our agenda adopted, and we've attended to the apologies to welcome again the DDG, the senior member of DTI, Dr. Masotja, Consumer and Corporate Regulation Division, Mr. Kumkani, who's there, Sipa Mandla, Director, CCRD, Ms. Zodwa Matiwani, CCRD, Director, and Ms. M. Matonzi, Director, CCRD. And then, of course, we have the National Credit Regulator, the CEO, the most senior person there, Ms. Machagari, her deputy, Mr. Obert Tongwani, and the company secretary he's right here, Mr. Lesiba Mashapa. We then have our professore here, Professor Maseko, the chairperson of the National Consumer Tribunal. And in Parliament, for the Constitutional and Legal Services Office of Parliament, we have Advocate van der Merwe, Senior Parliamentary Legal Advisor, Legislative Drafting. And behind me, somewhere on my right, we have the Parliamentary Liaison Officer of DTI, Ms. Saraj Naidu, and other stakeholders present here with us, as well as the media. I really want to thank the media for taking the National Credit Amendment, the amendment to the National Credit Act, very seriously. It is a very important piece of legislation that we are addressing here. So thank you for your attendance as well. And now, members, thank you for being here this morning after a very long day yesterday, and we've got a long day again today. So we open up here, and most members will understand. We asked Advocate van der Merwe to please prepare something, and she indicated this was not the finest draft she has produced, but it does attempt to address these, because the DTI will speak to it first. But just to finish my sentence with respect to the advocate, we are often asked in this committee, where did this come from? Where did this come from? The advocate is putting up here. His own bill, is it? No. That is why she comes with what is called a framework draft. Because it is this committee, the members, who must tell her what to put in, not the actual language that she will use, but the principles. But they have decided, let DTI go first this morning. So Dr. Masotja, will you address us?
Good morning, honorable members. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, stakeholders and my colleagues. Yesterday, from the discussions, there was two areas that we wanted to flag or to bring to the committee, raised around the financial literacy capacity, and also there were some comments that we received from National Treasury that we did not go into in detail yesterday. We did not address them, so we thought that we could use this presentation to address the two areas. The bill seeks to introduce financial literacy training, which is twofold. It is financial literacy counseling and the training that are provided for in the bill. And we as the department and the NCR, we anticipate to follow this approach. And what we will be doing as part of the implementation is the development of the training material. And what the NCR will consider existing material, including that which is used by the industry, which will then be adapted to suit the targeted debt intervention consumers, including the translation thereof into all official languages. And as part of that process, there will be the appointment of suitable qualified trainers. And the NCR will appoint the internal trainers who will be based inside the organization. Mm-hmm. And we will also work with other stakeholders like our provincial consumer protection offices and other CETAs. And the CETAs will be approached to determine the capacity to assist with the training of the consumers. And this will also include the using of their trainers, their existing infrastructure. And we will also look at the training of trainers, and we call that outsourcing. So we will not necessarily be looking for service providers per se, but the outsourcing is NCR utilizing external capacity. So this will talk to the previous bullet that talks to using the provincial offices. And in terms of the methods for the financial literacy counseling, we will consider using online applicants where we will have online training video that will be utilized. So this video will be developed. So what we are trying to say is that we will be looking at different methods of reaching consumers, because we want to make this accessible and also user-friendly. For instance, many of us use smartphones, so we are also looking at cell phone applications for applicants, where we will then have some element of training, either in an online training video and so on. And applications received through the call center will be another method where telephonic counseling will be provided. With the other applicants, all other applicants, we will also look at the face-to-face counseling through the NCR's resources or the provincial consumer protection offices. And also radio sessions are also another opportunity to offer training, especially in rural communities, like your community-based radio stations will be utilized also to cascade this kind of training. And in terms of the literacy training itself, we will use the following methods. The consumers will be able to attend to face-to-face training. And this is a training that the NCR will provide. And this is where the CTAS and the provincial offices will also be used. And this means that this program can also be in other provinces. So we'll try to make it as nationally wide as possible. And for the applicants who are not able to attend the face-to-face training, there will be online training programs that are developed. And now we come to the crux of the matter, which is about the funding. How will this be funded? We currently have an estimation of how much we foresee this program to cost us. And we are looking at 47.
One moment. Where is the Honourable MacPherson? He's been asking about funding all along. Honourable.
No, he went out with the Business Day journalist.
To be fair, but on this occasion he hasn't. And these are the issues he's asking about, funding.
As his deputy in his absence, I'm here.
Yes, I know that you're his deputy, but he often repeats questions as if you have never informed him. I shall be taking no questions from him on funding. Right, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I don't think that we should waste time in wondering where members of the opposition are. We should just continue, please. Thank you.
Do you go ahead, Dr. Masocha?
The estimated cost of this is 47 million. We will require 47 million, and this 47 million includes the acquiring of the trainers, the materials, and everything that is related to the training. So we've taken the different factors into consideration to come to the 47 million. So this is an estimated figure that we foresee that we will need to undertake this kind of training. And we looked at other options of funding that we already have and the potential sources of funding and the existing mechanisms. We have a fund through the NCR. It's the payment distribution agency interest fund. It's a trust fund that is meant for education and awareness and literacy training for consumers, for over-indebted consumers. So there's already a fund that is existing. And we are saying that out of that existing fund, we are going to allocate 20% of that for debt relief training, financial literacy. So estimated in terms of what it could be, for argument's sake, an amount of 11 million or 10 million can come from that per annum. And we also are looking into the registration fees of the registrants of the NCR, your credit providers, your financial institutions that are registered. The fees have not been regularly updated. Since 2007, the fees were only increased once, in 2015 or 16. So we have an opportunity to have annual fee increases. So we want to use this opportunity to fund this literacy from the registration fee of registrants. and then the normal budget allocation of the National Treasury. As I have indicated yesterday, we have already started engaging with Treasury about this bill and the fact that we are going to need funding going forward. So they are aware in that regard. So when we look at these three options, we think that we will be able to fund debt relief literacy because we will not just rely on the reprioritization of the MTF budget, but then we're looking at other mechanisms. And as we go forward, there might be other opportunities of raising funds over and above this, but we are still going to explore other measures to raise funding for debt relief. And to make this more practical, we had a debate about this, a discussion to say that it is possible, Chair, that when the bill is implemented, when it becomes effective, we might be ready for the rolling out, and that some of the activities that are required can happen from now. We can start with the planning, we can start with the actual actions that can happen. And the first thing that we are planning to do in the next 6 months is around the review and the revision of the registration fees. So we are going to start looking at that. The NCR is going to look at that. And also, in terms of the partnerships with the other training providers, the provinces, the CETAs, for example, also from national, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, we have started engaging with them as well to say with their capacity in their legislation, their new legislation, and the infrastructure they have, we can look at exploring customizing their training facilities for credit. It's something that we are discussing with them. Things will be concretized, but the MOUs will be developed to formalize this. So these are the potential partners that we are looking at to implement the debt relief literacy program. And we will also have more consultations with National Treasury over and above the normal budget processes to ensure that they understand and we are on the same page in terms of the demand and the need for us to prioritize this, the funding for this intervention. And the development of the training material is something that we can start. It's within the next 6 months, we'll be moving on that to start with that process. And there is a plan that we have developed with the NCR that is going to look into this. So it's something that can start immediately as well. And in principle, what we want to ensure is accessibility of this, the simplicity of it, taking into account that not everybody can read or write the literacy element and the language issue. So we will take into account all these factors, Chair, to make it more relevant to the target market that we're talking to. So this is most of the things that we have discussed regarding the training. We think that it is very practical and we can be able to implement, and most of it is within our control as the DTI, and we'll see how we maneuver with our existing resources. Yeah. So the other element of this presentation is on the submission that we received from National Treasury. It came after the other comments, but we thought because Treasury is our fellow sister department, we can flag some of the things they have raised. But following the same principle, Chair, of treating them like other stakeholders, what we did with the other stakeholders was to say we only looked at what was advertised. We acknowledged their input, but what they provided was also broad. They went into other areas that were not advertised. So I will see how I navigate in this presentation to ensure that we also apply the principle of fairness. But I will acknowledge their comments, but maybe in terms of responding, we'll just skip through some of them just to focus on the main areas that are relevant for the submissions that we have received. They raised some of these comments. I advocate also touched on them yesterday, but from the DTI side anyway, I'll repeat what was said yesterday. They raised an issue around the mandatory credit life insurance. They say that they support the clause on that, but provided that it is done in such a way that it is a cost-effective and eliminates a need to subsequently extinguish debt on this basis. And also, they are saying that there's a need for a deeper discussion on the effects of these proposals in consultation with the Financial Sector Conduct Authority and industry. So they are saying we must consult with them. And also, they are saying that in order to enable the minister to prescribe a credit intervention, they are concerned about the role of the minister to override contracts if we allow him to prescribe on that intervention. I think yesterday this was discussed, elaborate the powers of the minister. So they've repeated that, and they propose that the clause around this be deleted. And in terms of the minister's powers to prescribe a financial literacy and capability program, they are proposing that efforts be coordinated to avoid duplication with their mandate, which is under the legislation and Section 57 of their legislation, which is providing for financial customers and potential financial customers. And our responses, we say that we will be consulting on the issues of the credit life, and the issue around the powers of the minister is a matter that is within the committee under discussion, and it has been addressed also in the previous discussions, not only for this current advertised clauses. And as far as the training is concerned, we would like to explore collaborating with them on the training. However, because they come from a different sector and they are informed by the specific law, we will ensure that their legislation and our legislation are respected in terms of their functionalities, and that we will assist each other to build capacity. We don't see our role as contradictory. In fact, we complement each other. There is a greater need out there. So we could use their resources or their infrastructure to bring in the issues of credit. So we think that there's a big scope for working together with National Treasury on the financial literacy element. So their concern is noted, but we don't foresee that there will be challenges around that. And they were also concerned about the term of debt intervention applicant, and they are advising that it should be clear that it refers to individuals. It's on slide 9, rather than because the meaning can be construed to be talking to sole proprietors and trusts. And they also recommended that the definition of financial literacy be relooked and be turned into financial capability. So they would prefer that instead of using literacy, we talk to capability in terms of the ability of a person to deal with their financial situation. And they also raised a concern about the extension of the scope of debt counselors to decide on maximum interest. And also they said the lack of defined guidelines on how fees are charged may render the process unworkable. In terms of the debt applicant, intervention applicant, although it's not an issue that was raised for the advertisement, we don't think that there's clarity regarding who is a debt intervention applicant in the bill. And regarding the definition of financial literacy, we think that the definition is in line with the widely used terms in terms of policy. Generally, when you talk about skills and knowledge of the people, we talk about financial literacy than financial capability. It is a semantic issue, Chair, but widely in terms of best practice, we normally debate on financial literacy than on financial capability. So we, as the DTI, although it's not a major issue, we wouldn't mind retaining financial literacy as it is. But if it's up to the committee, but it's not really, in terms of best practice, I think financial literacy is the widely commonly used but it's a small issue. It's not something that really doesn't change the gist of what the bill is trying to do. But we thought we should just say that. And regarding their concern about the debt counselors being able to reduce interest and fees, debt counselors make recommendations on the restructuring to the courts. They do not decide on the fees and the rates. They are not empowered to make such decisions. So that concern is not really a challenge. And they also raised the issues around the powers in a different way, but it's been responded to. And then the socio-economic impact assessment by the DTI, in their letter they said that the focus should be on impact and implementation. And the study that we are currently undertaking is looking at more on the implementation of the bill by the NCR and the NCT. So, Chair, we have addressed, we have noted their comments and we have responded to them. And they are addressed also in the bill. And this is the end of our presentation. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Masocha. I think, members, that what we did yesterday may be the way to go. Shall we get both presentations, the advocate coming in with the draft, so that we can address issues there? So what you're addressing, presenting us with then, advocate, is basically a framework, is it, of the new draft?
Yes, Jay. In fact, the document has been handed out to members. If the chair would just give us maybe just 2 seconds, so we just swap over computers, so I can get.
All right. No, thank you very much. It'll give me a chance to get down my executive secretary. I may add, members, that my executive secretary, Tandisa Makanda, returns to us after maternity leave. And her little son is doing very well. She's looking very well. And she will be coming down in a minute, and you'll be able to see for yourself how well she is looking. see, given that we started later, we're not having a tea break because we had we only started at 10, as it were, but we will be going out to for a lunch break at 12:30. So I think it's about 11 now, is it, or 10 past? Do go ahead, Advocate.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to reiterate to members, the document that you see is a draft in which I have taken into account where the submissions highlighted things that could improve the draft. I have taken that into account, even if it weren't on clauses that were advertised, simply because I believe if we can improve the bill, we should do so. So I'll take you through those. But there are also those where I've made certain recommendations yesterday. There aren't final decisions on them from this committee. So there are proposals. They're not cast in stone. It is for you to see what it would look like, and then we can have a final decision on that. In fact, there might be things that are not indicated, but I will highlight them. So in the long title, the changes that you see there resulted from a submission from Nedbank, where they pointed out that certain aspects weren't in the long title. So what I did was I worked through the bill again, and I made sure that all the pertinent issues are in fact reflected in the long title. So I'm also now providing for logistical arrangements in respect of working with the debt relief by the NCR, providing for a court to make an order related to debt intervention, for the court to determine the maximum interest and for guidance to be prescribed in that regard. Then there at the bottom of page 2, I've deleted the word financial literacy based on the request from National Treasury. What they said was that both financial capability and financial literacy, as it is defined in the bill, mean the same thing. And their proposal was to delete financial literacy. But as we've now heard from the DTI, they request that we rather delete financial capability. That's a small change to do. The idea is that one of the two terms will be deleted. I don't see
interrupt
any problem.
You there, Advocate. Members, when the Advocate makes these statements, she's simply making a proposal to us. The final decision is are the members here. You're going to say, we want financial capability or no financial literacy. Is that clear? So that there's no misunderstanding. All right, go ahead.
Thank you. So the proposed deletion there is simply to say this is based on proposals from National Treasury, but like I say, DTI has requested a different deletion. From a legal point of view, there would not be a problem to just retain one of the two terms. It was, in fact, Treasury that proposed the two terms, and they gave us the definitions for them. But I suppose once, you know, as a bill develops, you start seeing that things no longer gel. And I suppose that is why they're now making a different proposal. So from a legal point of view, I don't see a problem with just one of them. Then on the next page, you will notice there that this draft then deletes the...
One moment, Advocate. Honourable Flanguini.
Yes, sorry, Chair. Sorry to interrupt you, Advocate. Just on your earlier point that you have said, Chair, when the Advocate is speaking, should we now vote whether we are going to take literacy or capability? Because I want to propose literacy.
We're not at the absolute point of voting on things now. However, no, it's good that we get this quite clear. It is up to the committee. But what I'm suggesting is, as she does this, we then take a break after about 4 or 5 pages, for example, and we then say, right, and then, but, so you'll go up first on that proposal, Honourable Flanguini. Okay, right. So let's move.
Thank you, Chair.
Sorry, Honourable Khadebe.
All right, thank you, Chair. I think what the Advocate was going to do is to provide us with alternatives about what we're having. But the decision will only going to be taken when we deal with this thing clause by clause, then that is going to be final. Yeah, please.
What I'm saying is slightly different, but it's a proposal which will take us forward. Where there are the simple things, we say yes. Where we find there's going to be a debate, we take it forward, yes. So I think while we are on the same page, perhaps Honourable Khadebi, right. Advocate van der Merwe, I'm looking at how long we go here. It's about 36 pages or so. So we'd stop round about 15 or 18 and just check.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Maybe, Chair, just to confirm, I would need some guidance where there are options. Because in order for the committee in the end to vote, it would be preferable to have the option that the committee prefers in that draft. Then on page 2 at the top there,
Honourable MacPherson.
Yeah, sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Advocate. I'm a bit concerned because you will recall yesterday that I had requested the committee to consider what we would do with the public submissions that we had received. Mm-hmm. Now I would like to have had a discussion around that, or I would have hoped to be able to engage those people before we start going through this. It would have just made more sense if that proposal had been accepted. And how are we going to deal with that? Because I think that would affect this discussion if in fact we actually were going to consider those discussions.
In actual fact, I thought we had reached an agreement. But let me just take the two other hands that were up, Honourable Williams, followed by the Honourable Khadebe.
Chairperson, we have had so many engagements with everybody around this bill. There's no need to have engagement further around this. I reject the Honourable MacPherson's proposal. And if I think we should vote on it, if there's a problem, we need to vote on this, and we need to just move ahead, because these are stalling tactics, Chairperson. It's clear that what they are is stalling tactics, an attempt to undermine this process. So I think that we should move forward. We do have the written submissions. If there are points in the written submissions that want to be raised here, the members obviously are free to raise those and refer to the written submissions, but to bring everybody back again is just another stalling tactic, and I think that this bill has been before us since 2013. Honourable MacPherson must remember that the subcommittee was established when Honourable Hill Lewis was here, and so that's been quite a long time. So, I mean, we've engaged on this with many, many stakeholders, and I think that now we must move forward and start moving into the clause-by-clause situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Khadebe.
I think Honourable Williams has covered the way.
Well, I have been advised by Mr. Hermans, who is, after all, that is his role in terms of the table, is just to get the matter clear once and for all, we need to formalise our decision with respect to the proposal that has been made by the Honourable MacPherson. He has made a proposal. It's on the table. Let's get it seconded. Yes, Honourable MacPherson.
You know, I really would have, you know, thought or hoped that you would rule those sorts of aspersions from the Honourable Williams, you know, out of order. You know, if I had made those sorts of comments, I'm sure that I would have been pulled up, you know, to say, you know, as a committee, you know, we don't cast aspersions to say that people are deliberately trying to stall things, and, you know, I mean, that's really not fair. You know, I simply had raised a question of process that I myself as a member had wanted to interact, and I think that those comments are unfortunate, to say the least, but there you go.
Yes, this is the thing with comments and adjectives of that nature. They are indeed subjective. But yes, I take your point. But now what we do need to do, so that the proposal you have made forward is very clear. You have put it on the table very clearly again. And I'm asking you, someone within the committee to second it, please. Seconded by the Honourable Kacharia. Right. Now, is there another proposal? I'm going to take the proposal from the front, Honourable Mantash.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we had exhausted the point, Chair, that we have seen almost every stakeholder in this committee and have listened to them and have considered their proposals. If you look at the bill itself, most of the proposals have been taken care of. And yesterday we made a proposal that this bill is still going to be taken to the NCOP. If there's any stakeholder that feels that their proposals have not been taken care of, they can go to the NCOP and make their presentation. But we as a committee, we don't need to call any stakeholders again. We are done. We don't support that proposal.
Right, so in your opinion, you are indicating you don't support it for the reasons given. Right, let's indicate then there was an objection, if you like, in one respect, but it was also seen as a proposal. Is it seconded?
Chairperson, I second the proposal of Honourable Mantash.
There are two proposals on the table. As you know, and Honourable MacPherson, you are right in that regard. It is very seldom that we put things to a vote in this committee. That is correct. But we're not going to reach sufficient consensus on this issue. So I am obliged to put it to a vote. Those in favour of the first proposal put forward and tabled by the Honourable MacPherson, that we invite stakeholders back who've made new comments, those in support should raise their hands.
Chair, can I just ask that you frame the question correctly?
You can frame it yourself.
Okay, I think the question for Hansard should be, does the committee support the proposal for those that have made submissions on the three new clauses in the bill be invited to the committee for an opportunity to present to them? That's how the question should be framed.
Right, thank you for reframing it correctly. Thank you. Those in, we have already said that those in favour of the first proposal tabled, and I did see two hands up. I saw yours, Honourable Kacharia. We have two hands from the DA, and those not in favour, please raise your hands. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That is from the ANC 4 and the EFF 1. Right. So on that basis, the committee formally is saying, no, we don't accept the first proposal. And to contextualise it, as you know, Honourable MacPherson, we didn't get 6 comments back. I understand it wasn't even 1/6. How many was it? Thank you very much. So what we are going to do, we did publish those three issues because they had come, the committee was of the opinion that members would not have known about it before. Not members, the general public or stakeholders. They are now aware of it. We do have the responses, and you can see that the DTI is taking account of them in its comments, and so is the advocate. It is essential for the committee to take account of those comments as well. Absolutely essential. And to weigh it up. All right? And on that particular note, we need to proceed. So where we are right now with the advocate is page 3. Is that right?
Yes, Chair. Thanks, Chair. On the top there, I'm just from the long title of the bill, I'm proposing the deletion of the power to the minister to prescribe debt intervention. This is probably something that will be discussed rather at the actual clause, but that was one of the issues on the table. Should the minister be allowed to prescribe debt intervention? My concern was that the longer-term measure already provides for that and it makes it superfluous. Then I've simply added something about our transitional provision as well. It's not really necessary to include it, but I thought let's be thorough on our long title, and that's why I've included it there. The next change, I think, is only on page 4 at the top there. The proposed deletion there relates again to the prescribed debt measure. So it's a consequential amendment. Should the committee decide that the prescribed debt measure should be removed, then we need to just effect this consequential amendment. The little bit lower, paragraph B of the debt intervention applicant, is a similar consequential amendment. If we remove the power to the minister to prescribe, then the clause that deals with increasing this amount of 7,500 will then become 2 capital A and will no longer be 2 capital B. So it's just a consequential amendment.
Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, I don't think that we should be making or be listening to amendments on that may occur from amendments that might happen later. Do you know what I'm saying? The things that we're hearing about now is about the minister's powers, which may be removed, but we haven't removed them yet. So surely we should just move along until we've got to things that we've actually, and then those amendments will happen automatically. Or else what's happening is it seems it's almost like predetermined that we've removed the minister's powers, when in fact that decision hasn't been made yet. Thank you.
I think that is wise guidance. Let us just deal with pertinent facts and then come back if necessary.
Thank you, Chair. What I'll do is I will skip over consequential amendments, in other words. On the next page, page 5, there's just a proposal to remove then one of the two words, either financial capability or financial literacy. If members will just bear with me because I need to then just find the next relevant proposal or major proposal. The next major proposal is on page 7, and it is clause 6, section 69, capital A, subsection 2. What we have there is that there was a concern expressed by BASA that the regulator might not be able to publish certain information which is required by this specific act, which could then lead to reckless lending, etc., etc. So what I'm proposing there is that we add the word this act.
Sorry. Honourable Williams, we do need to move, but let me take your point.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think that when something has been included because, for instance, in this case, BASA has said, or it's a point that BASA made, I think we should be told where BASA said this. Is this in the latest inputs that we've received in writing, so that we can show that we're not, you know, we don't just put these in file 13. Thank you.
One moment, please. Now, every time I have to deal with something on the administrative side, I have to just hold on, given the request for the committee to apply its mind. So, one moment. Right, back on track. Are we on track then? Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. In fact, the comment that I referred to from Nedbank regarding the long title, as well as this comment from BASA, are both from the second round of publications. So in other words, it was the comments made by these companies on the call for the three, on the three specific clauses. However, what we've also done is we cannot take into account comments on policy on clauses that weren't called, where there weren't calls for comments, because that would be unfair towards other members of the public. But what we did do was where there were comments on other clauses that related to technical matters or things that could improve the wording of the bill, that I have taken into account, and that is where I'm making these proposals. So that, in other words, that we don't ignore things that are not policy related, but it improves the quality of the legislation.
Honourable MacPherson.
Chair, I just want to ask a question. Advocate, or maybe the NCR CEO might be able to answer this. Is a record with respect to if a person has been through debt counselling, is that something that is publicly accessible to the or by the credit unions or any financial institutions? So if someone's been through debt counselling, is that is there a public record of that is kept? Can I just have an answer to that question?
Yeah, I thought on one hand we had taken the decision to get to page 15 and then engage, but I did want to, it may have been a process question, that's why I allowed it on the floor. So can we come back to that, please? As I said to Honourable Tlangwini, can we come back to that issue? We just want to let this go with a free run for page 15, 16 or so.
Thank you, Chair. So the proposal here on section 69, capital A, and subsection 2 thereof, is just to make it very clear that it is this Act or any other applicable law. It's a little bit overstating the obvious, but if it makes things clearer, because like as we know that we don't just draft for ourselves, so if it makes it a bit clearer, the proposal would be let us include that. It does not change the policy. It contributes to make things a bit clearer. If members would bear with me again, I'm just looking for the next point.
Chair, can I be assisted? I'm a bit behind what the advocate is saying.
Sorry, I didn't hear.
I'm behind what the advocate is saying. Can I?
I didn't hear it either. That's why I thought it's the same question. Could you repeat that, please?
Chair, what I was saying on section 69, capital A, was that in the last intake of comments, BASA made the comment that they were just concerned that the regulator might not be able to provide certain information, even if this Act, the Credit Act, requires them to give that information, because that specific clause does not use the word this Act. It just said in terms of law. Now, law implies this Act, but there is no harm in making it very clear that it is this Act or any other applicable law.
I'm going to ask you, Advocate, so that we don't lose our place, would you first mention the clause, in other words, clause 6 there at the moment, page 7, and then carry on. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The next one is on page 12. It is clause 11. And it deals with section 85. Right at the bottom there, paragraph C, subparagraph 2. In the latest round of comments, again, where the three clauses were advertised, DICASA proposed that it may be made clear that the magistrate court can reduce interest and costs to zero in respect of a debt review and debt intervention measures. The members will remember that we have expanded in the bill for the power of magistrates to, if they have sufficient information before them, they can make a debt intervention order. The comments from the previous round indicated that it would almost be a waste of cost for a magistrate who has all the facts to have to refer it to the regulator to do a review, who then refers it to the tribunal. You just lengthen the process. If there's sufficient facts, then they should be able to do the debt review. And of course, it must be that they will be able to reduce the interest. So what I'm proposing here is that we simply add the section 87, which then deals with that kind of order. So it is clear that it is in respect of both where that will apply. So that is just what that is about. If members would just give me a moment again to find the next relevant clause. Thank you, Chair. Yes, indeed, on page 14, it is clause 13 dealing with section 86, capital A. Again, the issue of just using either financial literacy or financial capability. So that is just what that is about. And Chair, then we are going past page 15. So I don't know if you want me to continue. Can I carry on? At the top then of page 16, that is, I think it's still clause 13. Yes. And it's section 86A, dealing subsection 10. What was pointed out here during the last intake of comments by BASA was that what we did with this draft is we copied from the existing wording of the Act and we then populated it into our bill and just made the necessary tweaks. And BASA pointed out that we are talking about a review in the subsection, I think it's 10 and it's also the same in 11. And what it could be confused with a debt review while we are actually talking about debt intervention. So I thought let's make it clear that we are talking about debt intervention. So I'm proposing that we remove the word review and we make it clear that we are talking about something that forms part of the debt intervention. So that is both 10 and subsection 11 as well. It's the same issue. Then subsection 12, that first deletion there, this relates to a comment made by Advocate Trengov about inconsistencies. And yesterday we spoke about it a little bit. What we have, section 86A, subsection 1, says a requirement for debt intervention applicants to earn below 7,500 and the debt must be below 50,000. Then we allow for the minister in the regulations clause to up that amount over time. But we did not want that to be done in respect of the extinguishing portion because that is a short period measurement. But to exclude that then in subsection 12 seemed to have caused that concern about inconsistency. And at first I thought it's not really possible to take it away and put it rather in the regulations clause. But I worked on it yesterday and I think I have a proposal that could work. So first it will be deleted here. In other words, this section 86A will not make mention that you cannot increase the amount in respect of a candidate for extinguishing of debt. It will not make any mention of that. We'll only learn about that later in the bill. In other words, in the proposal that I'm doing now. And the reason for that is so that we don't cause a confusion in this specific section. So
would it go just to continue what you're saying?
It will then go into the regulation section. So what we have, sorry, Jay, I thought there was a hand. I thought there was a hand. So what we have is Section 86A will set the requirements for all debt intervention applicants. And we won't talk about exceptions or changes or anything here. Then when we get to the clause that deals with the regulations, Clause 29, then we will say that the minister can increase the amount. And we will then make it clear that that adjustment, however, does not apply to a candidate where the referral is for suspension or extinction. So in other words, we'll make the distinction in one place so that there's no confusion in the mind of someone who reads the bill for the first time. Because it seems that if you read the bill for the first time, the image is created in the person's, in the reader's mind, that although you set this requirement, you suddenly only require it for people who go for extinguishing and suspension and extinguishing. And that is not the intention. So my proposal is, let's take it out here, stop any confusion, and we rather deal with the wording where the exception should be then made, in other words, in the actual regulation section. So it's a bit disjointed now because we don't see the other wording now, but when we get to that clause, I will then remind members that we've deleted it here.
Yes, and then just to guide you, then page 18, we won't deal with, it's just financial literacy and capability. Again, we've dealt with that. And then we will finish on page 20 for the moment, if you'll deal with the issue on page 20.
See, if I can just first deal with an issue on the end of page 16. I haven't dealt with that one yet. It goes over on page 17, the sunset clause. So what we had was that the minister could extend this clause. Advocate Trengov was concerned that this might be unconstitutional. In my presentation yesterday, I indicated to members, I don't think that it's an amendment of the bill. So I don't think it's delegation of plenary powers. I think it's implementation. But there are other ways of achieving the same result. So I would recommend that we rather do an amendment. And the amendment that I'm proposing is that instead of the minister actually extending, we require the minister to table a report in the National Assembly no later than 36 months after this process has started, setting out what the findings of that review is. What I then don't say in the bill is, of course, that Parliament at that stage will then decide what should happen based on the findings of that review. But this is then the proposal that I have there. Then page 18, as the Chair said, is just the financial literacy issue. And then page 20, there was just a comment there from by Barsa that the word credit was left out. It is clause 15, section 87A. On page 20, it is paragraph B of subsection 4. So we're just adding the word credit to make sure that it reads correctly. And then that is up to page 20, Jane.
Right. Now, we will take members in this order. At first, we began with Honourable Tlangwini. That very first issue that did come up, which was, looking at financial literacy or capability. And just reminding members, again, of our process, we're just looking at this in principle at the moment. We aren't voting on it. We're simply saying, this is a draft, a framework draft. We want to ensure that the next draft we look at will be informed by members. But we can't thresh out things for 3 hours today. That's what I'm saying. So let's take you first then on this issue, Honourable Tlangwini, which was put forward to members, the options.
Thanks, Chair. Then I won't put any more emphasis on it, Chair. It's quite simple. I propose literacy.
Do we all agree in principle, members? Honourable Khadeb?
I second that, Chair.
So we're talking about in principle.
Or was it?
Yes, intervention there, page 4. Well, I see a deletion there, yes. Which book? Yeah.
That was what I think Honourable Williams was referring. Isn't that right, Honourable Williams? We then go to page 5. Is that main point? But I think it's, let members just note that it is consequential. I can't quite read the writing in the little pink box. It's very tiny. So as long as it's saying consequential, then we're fine. Right, are we then on page 6? Or is that another consequential amendment?
That one is also consequential, Chair. The next
right.
Big amendment is on page 7.
Right.
And that is the proposal to just have this act added.
Honourable Maxwell.
Sorry, I just want my question answered.
Yes.
And then I'll proceed from there.
Right. It was, in fact, on the section, though, wasn't it? Right. And the question, if you would put it again, please.
I just want to know from the NCR CEO, a person who has been through death counselling, is that information publicly available to credit providers?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just to respond to Honourable McPherson's question, once a consumer is under debt review, that information is flagged on the credit bureau records, so that it's available, you know, to all credit providers.
So then my question to the advocate would be, someone who is under debt intervention, will that information be publicly known on the credit bureau?
Thank you. Yes, it will be. It's the same principle will apply. So what we provide for in clause, I think it's clauses 13, 14, 15, where we go through the order, the National Credit Regulator must inform all credit bureau of an application, the status of an application, and the progress of the application, as well as any order that was received under that debt intervention. So there is quite a number of steps that will be placed on credit bureau, which is then in fact why Bartha made the comment that they would like or that they request that we make it very clear that this act, the information required by this act can be made publicly available, because that information will go to the credit bureau.
Honourable Macpherson.
Thank you. So I would be satisfied then if that is the case, that would satisfy Bartha's concerns about the information being publicly available, reducing the ability to lend recklessly then.
Right. No, thank you very much, Honourable Macpherson. And I think this is very healthy engagement that's going on. Right. So we then move again. I see. We come to, is it page 12? Just that page 12, advocate?
Yes, Chair. Page 12 is then just to make it very clear that the zero rating of a magistrate court is not just in respect of debt review, but also debt intervention measures, because we have given that power to the magistrate court so that the magistrate court can also do a debt intervention.
I see Honourable Williams very happy. Honourable Macpherson.
Thanks, Chair. I'm not sure that we've actually agreed to this as yet. As a committee, I don't recall when we took a decision that we actually agreed to this particular clause, because I certainly want to have an in-depth discussion around the ability to zero rate interest. So I just want to know when we can do that.
I think, you know, what I omitted to say is these issues where we really want to unpack it again, we need to flag. Okay, so are we agreed, Honourable Macpherson? We'll flag it for the moment as we move through?
We can flag it, but I mean, I, as long as it's implicitly clear that no concrete decision on this by the committee has
been
taken.
That's always been the case, Honourable Macpherson, you know that. So it's a red flag, you know, there's no green or black and white or whatever you want to call it, no checkered flag. Right.
Can we move on to the next issue, please? Is that page 14?
It is page 16 in fact.
No, page 14 is all we've dealt with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Page 16, is it? I can't see. 15.
Page 16 at the top there. This was just to make sure that when we talk about debt intervention, we don't use the word review, so that it's not confused with the debt review. We talk about debt intervention. So it's just a clarification that is proposed.
Again, as we're all looking here, Boss has had a lot of comment to make, and we've dealt systematically with all of its comments, and by the looks of things, fully accommodated them so far. Right. Do proceed.
Thank you, Chair. The next one, I would almost suggest, it's still on page 16, and it is about removing that confusion. Yeah. So the sunset clause where we say that you cannot adjust for this person, can I ask that we perhaps just leave it for now and rather discuss it when we get to the regulations clause? Because this is a simple deletion. The important part is how we will word it in the regulations part. If we do not like it there, then I simply come back and undelete this.
Yes. Well, let us just check with Honourable Williams, the subcommittee chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I just want some clarity. I don't think we should wait until the regulations before we discuss this. So what I'd like
minute,
to know...
Just a minute. Look, there's a lot of hilarity here in the ANC. Now, please.
We thought the ANC would disband the subcommittee. There's no law by subcommittee.
No, of course, it is. It's not disbanded. We're not disbanding anything. We've simply set it aside, members. We've simply set it aside. All right. Now, let us move. You can see how certain... No. You know, it seems that certain political terms like disbanded suddenly opens the whole house to hilarity. Now, come on. Honourable Williams, will you make your point?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I just want some clarity on this removal of this Clause 12 or 12.6. If we define... You know, this is where we're defining who it is. It's like under 7,500, 50. Where else are we going to define this? Is it only going to now exist in the regulations, which means that could change, you know? So I'm a little bit, I know it has to change with inflation, et cetera, but I do think that, I just want to know why are we removing this? Because surely somewhere we have to define who qualifies for this measure, you know, in the early, you know, in the actual bill, not in the regulations. Thank you.
Are we all on the same page? Yeah. Right.
Thank you,
Advocate
Chief.
Van der Merwe.
In fact, I think that is the exact confusion that I'm trying to remove. What we have is, let's go back to page, page 13. And we look at clause 13. Section 86A, subsection 1. We say a debt intervention applicant may apply to the National Credit Regulator. Then we need to remember the definition of a debt intervention applicant is a person who earns less than 7,500 rand. So that is first where we say what the salary, the income could be. Then we say may apply in the prescribed manner and form if that debt intervention applicant has a total unsecured debt of no more than 50,000, or such an amount as may be prescribed by Section 171. So, what does that? This is where our criteria is set out, and you read it with the definition. Now, this applies to all debt intervention applicants. Then we allow the minister in Section 171 to increase that amount. But we don't want that increase to be in respect of the shorter term measure. So because we don't want it in terms of the shorter term measure, subsection 12 then said your subsection 6E candidate, the suspension extinguishing candidate, can never earn more than 7,500 or have more debt than the 50,000. The problem is how Advocate Trengov read this is that this sets a different requirement for that candidate. So
can I please ask the media not to engage members of the committee? No. No, it's always been our protocol. We're actually in the middle of an engagement. Please. No,
I
do not want a dialogue.
I do so, but when I do step outside, I get berated in my absence.
No.
So.
If you want a formal ruling on it, I will. But I do not think the media require a formal ruling. They are fully aware. We are undertaking... All right, let me put it to you. Clearly, this has to be clarified. If this bill wound up in court, does this look like you're applying your mind if you're engaging with the media? No. And we cannot allow that. We cannot. So that is why I took personally to heart myself the comment that was made about all members of the committee, including myself, in the chamber, Good Hope Chamber, when an email was sent to me saying they want it, you know, they would appreciate it if all members of the committee, including the chair, applied their minds at all times and did not engage in anything else while people were on the floor. And I think that is important, which is why I apologize personally to the writer. It is important. Now, that was not even a bill. This is a bill. It is a bill. And judgments in the Constitutional Court have referred to people who are sleeping while a bill has been engaged upon. It is a serious matter. Honourable Khadebe?
No, Chair, I think you have dealt with it properly. I think that just forward, moving forward, only the staff must interact with the members of the board.
But where we are now, I did see two hands up at the back, but the advocate was on the floor while that was happening, and I want her to complete her statement. Honourable MacPherson, I'm not taking your hand at the moment. I want to proceed with Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. So the reason for removing this here is that it is a bit out of context in this section, and that is why it could cause confusion. So we say what our requirements are in subsection 1, and then when you get to 12, it looks like there's a disjuncture. So if members in your bill would go to page 37, you will see that there's a paragraph D inserted there. Now, that paragraph D forms part of a subsection where we allow the minister to adjust the income and to adjust the maximum debt amount. Paragraph D then says, this adjustment does not apply to a person who where the referral is for suspension or extinguishing. So we keep it, but we're just moving it to a different section to avoid confusion here, because it is a bit out of context.
Right. Honourable Williams, as you asked, is that acceptable then?
Thank you, Chair. I understand now what's happening there. I didn't see the 7.5 at one of the clauses, but I see where it has been included at the beginning of the... Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I want to take the Honourable Tierko first. She's had it up since before we had that interrogum.
Thanks, Chair. No, we were discussing. I showed him page 4, so that issue of 7.5 is there, and with the explanation of the advocate. But however, we flag this matter so that we make a decision. We flag it, Chair, so that we'll take a decision on the right.
Honourable MacPherson?
Before I get to my point, just to make the point that, you know, if I do something in the committee It's a problem. If I do something outside the committee, it's a problem. But there we go. What I want to just say about this particular point is that I'm a bit confused about the discussion that we're having, because, I mean, just yesterday, the Honourable Hadebe had said, you know, that this is one of the points, you know, that the ANC were graciously prepared to concede on. With respect
that,
to...
Sorry, just remind me, refresh my memory.
Yeah, with respect to the minister's ability to intervene or to increase or decrease amounts, as well as prescribed ministerial powers. You know, I can't speak in a meeting that I'm, you know, being, you know, sort of...
You are
the whole
protected.
Time.
I do need to come in just to point out that was on a different matter. That was on... But
okay, so it's not on
back,
this point.
No,
okay.
That's
well,
right.
Well, then once again...
But
I think,
do proceed.
Thank you. Then once again, then I think that it's not a formal decision that the committee has adopted, and that we ask that this is a red flag as well.
It has been flagged. Thank you. Right. Honourable Montash.
I thought you said we must concentrate on this bill, but when I hear Honourable McPherson putting some more other things, I also want to do the same and raise a concern whether it is correct for the business day to seem like it serves the DA MPs in this committee.
Yesterday, the Honourable Williams was
Well, Honourable Members, look, Honourable McPherson, look, fortunately in this committee we generally work together quite constructively. I do believe that. And we will continue to do that. Now, I don't want any more references to the media made. I thought I had already addressed the issue and closed the issue as well. Because we can never forget that they are an important institution in the country. And let us leave it there. Do proceed, Advocate.
The next issue is then on the bottom of page 16, going over to page 17, still in clause 13. This is this sunset clause, and whether the minister should be allowed, be given the power to extend it by way of notice in the Gazette, or whether we should rather just have the minister bring an impact assessment and then at that stage the National Assembly will decide whether to do it as a committee bill or whatever. Just to remind members, the rationale behind this was there was a concern raised by Advocate Trengo that we might be delegating plenary powers. I'm not of the view that we are, but what I also said was there are other ways of achieving the same result. So if we have that impact assessment, there's sufficient time to extend that in Parliament.
Mark, do we understand the substance of that?
Yes.
I see various gestures which I'm not yet equal, you know. Yes, Honourable Montash.
I think we also need to flag that one. Because we would be comfortable if the minister would, after that impact assessment, he tables that report to the NA. But we can flag it for further discussion.
Do we all appreciate the point of the flagging, I think, right? Let's move on.
Chair, I'm sorry, I might not appreciate. I might not understand the question. What we have now, the proposed amendment, is for the minister to no later than 36 months after this becomes operational to table a report in the National Assembly. So that is what is provided. I'm just not sure if there was something additional.
No. At one point there may have been an understanding that it would be removed, perhaps. But what the advocate is saying is that's been put in line with what had been said yesterday, the idea being, no, look, it needs to come back to us, to Parliament. And I thought at that time that all members of the committee were of the same opinion. So do we want to flag it? That is the issue, notwithstanding yesterday. Honourable William?
Chairperson, I agree with you on, do we want to flag this? Because we seem to all be agreed that after 36 months after the bill, the minister must come up with a report, send it to the House, say it's working fantastically, the Trade and Industry is a marvellous committee, brilliant bill, and then moving on from there. But if we all agree, then why don't we just agree and then this can become black right here? I don't know. I would just suggest that we accept it.
Well, that is where I was hoping you would conclude. So are we all in agreement in the principle? I'm looking at all parties. That the Minister brings a report back to the National Assembly. Honourable MacPherson?
Thanks, Chair. I do think that we need to flag this and discuss it further. So I would ask you to put it on your red flag list.
I don't want unnecessary flagging. You have a challenge with the issue because you yourself just now were saying that we were in agreement.
No. We didn't say that. What we said is that we want to red flag the point of being able to change the amounts of the income and the total unsecured credit. So, flowing from that is what he then does in doing so and bringing a report to the National Assembly. So I mean, we can't red flag one and not the other.
Let me allow the advocate to respond because I thought that in looking at this, that was a different issue, but I may have misunderstood it. Advocate?
Yes, Chair. In fact, it is a different issue. This report relates to whether the measure that deals with suspension and extinguishing, what that measure's impact is. So what we provided was the measure providing for suspension and extinguishing is limited to a 48-month period. What the bill in the draft as went to the public and to council provided was that the minister must do a review of the impact of that suspension and extinguishing portion of the measure. And then if that impact assessment appears to be that is effective, efficient, successful, etc., the minister can extend that 48-month period to whatever. Now, then there was a concern raised by Advocate Trengove, and what I'm proposing is that we remove that power of the minister to extend. We say to the minister, you must do a review of the impact of the extinguishing suspension portion. That impact assessment must then be tabled in Parliament within the first 3 years of that measure being operational. Then it will be for Parliament to consider that impact review and to decide, should it be extended, should it not be extended. So that is all that this deals with. It does not deal with any other powers of the minister.
And I think, you know, what I thought that all members agreed yesterday is we need to be cautious about the extension of the minister's powers. That merely underpins that point. Honourable Khadebe.
Chairperson, I think from the explanation of the advocate, it is clear that this thing is putting the National Assembly at the center again. Is there any need to flag that? I think that's what, in principle, we agree that. Let us remove the power from the minister, but the minister must give a report to Parliament. I think we are in agreement. We know that immediately the report is gone to Parliament, the Speaker will refer it to the portfolio committee. We look at that, we see whether it is desirable or not. So we didn't delegate this land legislative power to the minister. I think we're fine. Let's just pass it.
So the issue then is it's not dealing with amounts at all. It's purely minister, bring that report to Parliament on the extension of time. So I do agree on the one hand, Honourable MacPherson, that your earlier flagging with respect to the amounts of money needs to be flagged. Yes, we do agree. But I do think that we need to move on and not flag something that is clearly what the committee is saying, no, we don't want the minister to have this prerogative. All right, thank you. Sorry, did you have your hand up, Honourable Kachalia? Oh, no, that's good, that's good. Right. Brought us all back on track. Thank you. Back to yourself, Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. The next change that I can spot is on page 20, at the top there, that paragraph B, where it's just to correct the name of the National Credit Regulator.
Yeah. Something we had overlooked. And then?
Yes, Chair, we stopped at page 20, so if I can then move on.
And then you'll move on until the end. So on page
22, right?
Chair, yes, on page 22, clause 16, what the question is here is whether section 88B that deals with rehabilitation is still necessary for this bill. The question that came up from Advocate Trengrove was you only have a limit on the credit ability to apply for credit of a maximum of 12 months. In fact, most would probably be 6 months because the other 6 months is a discretionary period. Do you then really need a method of rehabilitation? You would probably find that by the time that you apply and you get your order, there's maybe a month left. So the question just is, it's not unconstitutional. There's no problem with retaining it. The question is just, so the actual application is on page 24, section 88B. So the question just is, do we still want this possibility of rehabilitation? Maybe just to refresh members' minds, what we had was, you might have a person who was retrenched, goes through this process, and in fact is now unable to apply for credit, then gets a lovely job, is able to again enter the credit market. And now there's this long period still ahead. I think at one stage it was between 3 and 5 years where the person couldn't apply for credit. But you would like this person to enter into the credit market again because they're now back on their feet, etc. So that's why we provided for rehabilitation. But now, if your period is now limited, do you still need it? Like I say, there would not be harm in keeping it. It is more a question of, do we feel that it is still necessary?
Right. So, you know, one of the critiques from those who commented, including our senior counsel, Trengrove, to whom we referred these issues to, was perhaps certain issues had been unnecessarily repeated. On certain occasions, the committee itself insisted, you will recall. Now, hang on, we know it's in the principle. We want it stated here clearly for emphasis or whatever. And in some ways, that falls within that broad ambit. So, no, there's nothing wrong in keeping it in, per se, but you know, if we're talking about trying to have an elegant bill, as it were, simple bill, this may remove some of the complexity. In short, you are saying it is superfluous. Is that what you're saying? It's you know, it can stay in, it can stay out. It's not going to make a difference. Honourable William?
Jefferson, I just want to know, if we remove this clause, will anybody be at a disadvantage if they do get a job after they've gone through the process? Will is there any possibility of people being disadvantaged by this being withdrawn? Thank you.
Jay, you know, there might be a person, let's say what the very worst case scenario would be that a person receives an order on the second day of January. The third day of January, they actually start a new job, and now they would like to start applying, but they received a 12-month limitation. So for the next 364 days, they will not be allowed to apply for credit. But it probably won't be 364 days, because I doubt that they will be able to get the application through within a day. So you'd probably look at someone, worst case scenario, being unable to apply for credit for perhaps 10 to 11 months. So if we feel that that makes worth keeping it, then we should keep it.
There was something, let me first take the Honourable William's hand.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think in that case then we should keep this in the bill, as it's not harming the bill, it's not harming anything, and we can deal with any loopholes because, you know, knowing our luck, we'll be the people that won't be able to access credit for 12 months or 11 months. I don't think we should allow it, so we should keep it. There's no problem with keeping it, so I think we should keep it in the bill. Thank you.
All right. Let me check with all parties, all members of the committee, including the DA. Are you of the same opinion? Or do you want to flag it for deeper engagement? Honourable Macpherson? There we are. Okay. I just have one question for clarification. And that is, at one point in time, especially after our visit to the UK, the study visit, I certainly, and I know other members, would have raised the issue that had come up there where, yes, you're on debt review or you can't access this, that, and the next thing for whatever reason. However, certain essential issues you would be allowed to take credit on. The purchase of a pair of school shoes, that kind of thing. Now, I don't know if that addresses this kind of thing. So they would say, no, you still can't access credit, you know. However, except on these ring-fenced issues or issues below a certain amount. Did we ever address that issue?
Chair, no, we did not provide for an exception for essentials. I know that there was a discussion on it. And then the end result was that we will not include it. I just cannot remember what the rationale was. Just quickly thinking, I do think that it will make it quite complex because you might have to have a list of things that that you then need to include or that the minister must prescribe, which I think I seem to think it was about that it might become quite complex, but I can't remember if there was another reason.
No, thank you for that clarification. Much appreciated. Can we move on, please?
Thank you, Chair. The next one is quite far down. It's on page 31. It is clause 25, and it deals with offences.
31.
On page 31. And it's actually just something that during the last round of comments, BASA pointed out that we actually deleted the reference. We make a reference here in paragraph F to a paragraph C, 106 subsection 2, paragraph C. But when we changed our draft, we deleted that paragraph C. So to cross-reference to a paragraph C is incorrect because it no longer exists. So it is, it's a drafting technicality.
Right, drafting cleanup. Carry on. Five, is it?
Yes. Chair, then the first on page 35, the first one there, B capital A, is just the issue of financial literacy. The next one, B capital B, is to make provision. In other words, what we're doing here is now we're addressing the concerns of the public during this last round, where they were saying, but if the magistrate's court is given this power to reduce interest rates and charges to zero, then there needs to be guidelines on how this must happen. I was of the view that the fact that the magistrate will have to have a hearing and that this happens on application should be sufficient, but DTI indicated that there would be some guidelines created for a magistrate. The problem is that our Act does not allow for such guidelines to have delegated legislation status. So if there were guidelines issued, they would have been like a reference book or, something like that. So if we want guidelines for the magistrate's court, then we need to make provision in regulations. So you will see two different colours there. That is because when I was working through the draft yesterday, I simply provided regulations to provide guidance to the... So in other words, the subsection starts with the minister, and then we go here.
Moment, are there page? Has everyone got the purple and red? A separate page 35 with purple and red. Honourable MacPherson, have you also got it? Okay. Right. Okay, we can proceed.
So the initial thought was simply to provide for the minister to make regulations which would provide guidance to the magistrate court when they're making this order to reduce interest. And then in thinking over this clause, I started being a little bit worried because what we are allowing the magistrate court to do, or what the bill is allowing the magistrate court to do by reducing interest rate, does constitute deprivation of property. Now, we spoke about it yesterday a lot, about what can be delegated, what can't be delegated, and I'm satisfied that we can give the minister the power to make guidelines to allow a magistrate to be guided by something so that you have kind of an application across board in different magistrates' courts. And in any event, your magistrate themselves will still have to conduct a proper hearing and apply the constitution. But I was thinking, I do not think that if we make this provision for the minister to make regulations, I think that there should be guidance to the minister what it is that we want the minister to put in this document that will be made available to magistrates. So what I've done is I've looked at some of the public submissions that we received on this, looked at the concerns raised, the things that they said, but you need to have this, you need to have that. So I've kind of made a list here to say then when the minister makes these regulations, he must take into account existing industry standards and practices. I've also provided for the agreement that we know about. So I'm saying this guideline must reflect insofar as it is possible your existing voluntary agreement that exists between credit providers, debt counselors, and the National Credit Regulator, which determines debt restructuring rules, and then those rules then give effect to concessions. So in other words, because that is what I understood from the DTI yesterday, was that the guidelines would very much rely on this agreement that the task team or something has put together. So let us then require the minister to look at that agreement, because we know that that has industry buy-in, even if it is only 18% that actually makes use of it. But when it was set up with industry in talks with industry. Then some of the concerns that were also raised was that, but if you now reduce the interest rate to zero, but the person drives a Mercedes-Benz, etc., then that would be unfair towards the credit provider. So one of the things was that you need to require luxury items to be sold. And trade industry actually proposed that we don't say the liquidation of luxury items. I just meant by liquidation making it into cash, but they were saying for the disposal of luxury items. But it's probably, I think all of these, the wording here needs to probably be thought about if we decide to include it. But the point is that your guideline to the magistrate court should be that the magistrate must consider whether there are luxury assets, and then those should perhaps be changed. You can't ride a BMW, but you pay 0% interest. Then also another proposal to guide the minister is that the magistrate court must first consider incremental and proportional reduction when they look at these charges. In other words, don't immediately go to zero. First look at whether 10% wouldn't work or 5% wouldn't work. And then I think that actually is maybe a little bit superfluous because we already have it in our voluntary agreement, but let's perhaps make it clear. And then the last one was something that I was a bit concerned about yesterday, but there's not much that we can do about it now. It will have to be in discussions of the committee with the insurance sector on credit life insurance. But I thought we could perhaps put something in to say that the magistrate court must consider the impact of a reduction of charges on any credit life insurance that's applicable to that credit agreement. So in other words, it might be that the magistrate court does not reduce the credit life insurance portion, so that that insurance remains on the debt. So this is the next big one that we need to consider. Should we give the minister this power to make these regulations first off, and then for the committee to decide? If we give the minister the power, do we open it up, or do we limit it a bit, and then we'll have to look at the wording. If I then continue on the same page, the subsection 2A, that is the power of the minister to prescribe debt relief measures. It is deleted, and I said yesterday that I've already with the draft, I've taken some liberties, but the proposal was from my side that it should be deleted because it is actually simply duplicating what we already have in practice. The current long-term measure would be exactly what is provided for here. So the proposal there is then to delete it, and then that goes over up until page 37, the bottom there, and then we will have just some consequential amendments. The last paragraph on page 38, paragraph D, is then the paragraph that I referred to that deals with the minister's power to increase the income and the debt levels, and then to say that this adjustment that we allow the minister to be able to make does not apply to a debt intervention applicant whose application is referred under section 86A, subsection 6E, in other words, for suspension and extinguishing. So if the minister makes an adjustment, that will not be an adjustment that takes effect in respect of that referral under for suspension. Then paragraph C is still related to the minister's power to prescribe, because remember we had to give definitions. So the definitions, if we agree that should be deleted, the definitions will then also be deleted. And I think that is the rest of the bill. The memorandum on objects also has some proposed changes, but those changes simply reflect what happens in the bill itself.
Well, look, we are at a point in time, before I take any hands at the moment, it's lunchtime, as I stated earlier. We will break sharply on time due to the fact that, we have different schedules during this period in Parliament relating to staff. So we are breaking now at this time to return at 1:30. To E239, this room, to return to this room. But the luncheon for members is not held here. It is held in the room that we were in yesterday, which is E209. All right? So we are coming back to this to conclude the work that we are doing. Thank you. Meeting adjourned until 1:30.